great to be back in Cork. The last time I was here was 5 years old, and I didn't like the cornflakes in the B&B because they put cold milk in them, and we had warm milk in them before. So, but I did get over it, and I have come back. So I couldn't believe I came back to such rain today. I don't remember that before. I've lived in London for many years, and obviously I've lived in a good number of different houses, and I'm going to read a couple of those poems. This is a poem about the house that you live in. You can't imagine that it won't always be your house, and you can't imagine someone else living there. And I'm also interested in the kind of the past of houses and the ghosts that inhabit them. And this is about imagining coming home very, very late. Our house. I come home late to find my key won't turn in the lock. Murmurs drift from rooms, through the letterbox, a child's bike, a woman's coat on the banister, beige. No one answers our door now, it's scarlet gloss dull. I walk up my neighbour's path, relief as she opens the door. But she shifts when I say, I'm from next door. No, some mistake, the next doors are long gone. No word will ever be back. People inside, no, never. She's not heard a pin drop behind those walls. When I get back to our red door, they're switching off lamps, climbing stairs. Our bedroom is the last to go. And I'm still talking about coming home late. My son told me the other day that his friend got a taxi home. It was a good night out, and then realised he'd gone back to the place he used to live. He had to walk miles to get home. Before, I'm still in that house with the red door, but before that, this was a shorter stay, as you'll find out from the poem. We actually stayed in the house for 3 years, and it was the first house that we actually owned in London, and we had small children, and I think you can put too much hopes and dreams and expectations into a place, but also I think the house's history is sometimes stacked against you once you've just moved in and people knock the door and they say, do you want to know what happened in your house? So, vacant possession. The spirits of our first real house hung in years of embossed floral patterns under layers of flaky wartime distemper. It wasn't ceiling damp, the wasp-riddled attic, the Labrador decomposing in a stair carpet among shallow lupins. It was rooms that would never be aired or dying and sniping. The summer couldn't reach corners, houseplants yellowed. Tiffany lamps, a dresser, strip doors did little to lift the chill. Our children's jokes rang in cupboards, hallways, landings. They complained of a cold underfoot. Vague histories savaged our night dreams, days we woke to a solemn inertia. Birdsong rarely graced our end of the street. The morning we left, the spirits rumbled, rattled windows, raised the garden shed like a playing card house, irked in the end at our lack of stay. And then there are the houses that you don't live in, that you almost got there and then something happened. And this house was is still on the edge of the District Line railway, so when I'm waiting for a train, you can imagine, you know, the life that you might have had in that house. And I was standing there one day and new people had moved in. Number 23 from the eastbound platform. She's there in a dust-sheeted room, hair tied back in my cotton smock, glossing a magnolia door at dusk. A child in a number 8 shirt ricochets his ball off that gable, the one with the fatal flaw, a live collie snapping at his heels as he dreams of his spurs trial. I'm winded with the ache for this house we never took. Joe took Grace Knight with District Line reckoning, both fast between exchange and completion. We signed, measured windows, Saw ourselves ride mornings without number to tired-eyed school-going children, swap tense morning signals under radio talk, scrape laminate windscreen frost. The Upminster 610 halt, French door handles rattle. Stepping into the front carriage, I feel a lurch, back, then forward, to nowness, to sills of peeling neglect, ivy sagged splintering trellises. The woman in the house lets us depart, sets her brush on the tin's edge. And I'll go back to one more, an early house, or the house I've always lived in and grew up in. And it's really about paint. I think there's something very evocative about the smell of paint. Maybe it's when you're a child, you're so near to the door jams and windows. But the whole texture and smell of paint, I keep trying to find this poem. We lived on a cliff, and you know, we looked across to one other house, and it was a Riviera style house with a swimming pool, and ours was not like that at all. First heartbreak. It's painting lines of oars in rows on scotch grass, painting floats, bargaining with August dust. It's my uncle priming tea house gables to dry flow under decades of tall spruce, branches filtering sunlight. It's the other uncle unearthing wartime regulation grey for a chicken shed, the displaced circling, scratching and grit, bemused. From the air there's nothing but ladders propped against blinding snow fence. That July, two brothers from the other side of the mountain, bleached overalls, blow torches, and a light blue Ford van, gave our bungalow two coats of brilliant white, the one time we'd see Gatsby brightness this side of the bay. White that's embedded in a lifetime of wedged windows, tacky door jams, blisters bursting in an noonday sun. White that's twinned with melted ice cream, cream soda, bags of marshmallows, broken hearts, and always a pup at the lowest rung, yelping at the sheer improbability. It's called Heartbreak because of the two brothers who came to paint the house. My friend and I were 14 and we fell in love with one called Wilbur, and he wasn't interested in it. My mother's generation grew up on Hollywood films, and my mother always talked about these films and film stars. And when she died, I tried to find a way of writing about a last journey, and it seemed that a journey by train over that vast expanse of America, stopping off at Midwest towns. Her kind of dream life would be a good place. Central time. We bore the 605 together after a 3-day layover. My mother has to know of it, the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe, and she's that girl again, under the projector's light beam, scarlet lipstick and monochrome grandeur, sweeping stairs, a charred woman, then someone walking you home. Tonight, central time, anxiety or overt terror, no idea where she's headed. I settle her in the dining car, offer the brief amnesia of hot coffee. She whispers the car steward's looks like a young Clark Gable, iron screamed and hisses the night long. Steam whistles at long gone crossings, whole counties of captive and storefront towns vanish. In the hotel cab, I expand on parting and sorrow. She's thinner than I'll ever remember. A non-committal clerk who's seen too many ships scrutinizes her bags, rings a death bell. She clutches a life in Kodachrome's in the fat handbag of the butterfly clasp, gives me her wedding ring for safekeeping as she faces the narrow stairs with her wooden fob room key. I just seen in reading that poem that that wedding ring, which I had for safekeeping 2 weeks ago, we got burgled in London, and they took everything.
Oh.
But you have to just be glad that you weren't there when it happened. That's London for you. I'm going to go back just a bit further in a kind of family thing. That idea of America being this huge expanse where you kind of build a Pullman train zipping across the landscape. The other place where you have so many trains is Russia, again, because of that vastness. And this poem is about my maternal grandparents, who both died tragically young. But in the poem, I put them on a train, and I've allowed them to grow old together, as you can do in the alternative world of a poem. Novgorod sightings. Virtual snow on the line, a starry Damask night. The train quits the virtual station. Well-wishers gather on the cinder path, not knowing how to say goodbye. Passengers with tall hats and half windows alight in the opening pages. A red signal park hut lasts an entire chapter. But the couple ring true, emerge from lost strands. There is grey in her hair now. Cologne hangs in the lulls of steel compartments. Destination, their long shot summer house. He carries her portmanteau in one hand, an octave mandala in the other. No need of words. Luggage racks cleared, supper car mantles cooling. Unlit factories, grain stores, mosques dissolve in the filters of darkness. Past telegraph poles, a lone traveller on a snowstorm bridge. Isolated railroad hospitals. He notices she's lost an earring. One freshwater pearl, a running motif. The rest is non-linear and poorly focused. The engine slows at the first tunnel, erases carriage after relentless carriage from the frame. And still with trains, but this poem was Poem of the Week in The Guardian 2 weeks ago. The poet Carol Rumans wrote about it. And after a while, you start to think, does she think that's really me in that poem? And so that, you know, you write a poem, and then when you see someone sort of talking about the poet rather loosely and the voice in the poem. So, well, I'm not saying. Interesting. Half-eaten fries, the remains of hash browns, fill the table's distance between them. She scoops the car keys, says she'll not be long. In the washroom mirror, she checks her face, close up, sees years of wearied waiting. She steps into a sticky afternoon. How long before he'll notice, before he'll ask? The forecourt is nauseous with diesel and ocean. Ask if anyone's seen a woman in middle years. She's onto the freeway, jittering across lanes. And why, he'll wonder, now that the kids are gone, now that they're free to hit the road each spring. She overtakes on automatic, clearing Carolina, recalls the one dream he had left of building a boat, upriver in summer, dry dock in winter, the two of them. An unforeseen calm settles with sundown. She longs for nightfall and unbroken stretches of highway. It's clear ahead as far as her eyes. I read the poem that won the Cardiff Prize a few years ago, and I'm certainly not the airline pilot in this poem. It's kind of set in 40s and 50s island hopping, the time of flying boats and flying down to Rio. Curacao does. A plane flies off a map's edge today. At the console, O'Hara inhales the ozone of Curacao dust. Manila postcards, weightless with pre-printed greetings, flutter in confined space, franked, allegedly signed. The manifests well under payload. Faces in cabin windows are breathing waxy masks, their sightlines uninterrupted by pitchy floods of eastbound ebony swans, the homes a chaos of tethered cockatiels, small gods from Suriname. Bursting valises disgorge, wristwatches, standby parachutes, a crushed trumpeter's mute. The co-pilot stones, isobar charts, taps the compass twice for luck. He mouths a childhood formula under pale water skies before resuming routine announcements to the remnants of a cabin crew. I'd like you to tell me about the first lines of that poem, A Plane Flies Off a Map's Edge, today. I wrote it on September the 11th when I was in an internet cafe in Birmingham, and I just got that line and then thought, you can never write about, and now we're talking about Bin Laden today, you can't write about something so enormous at the time, so you just know that something about plane travel has changed forever, and then you put the line away for a time, and then I found it a new vehicle for the poem. I did actually work out once that every word in that poem is worth £52. Is that so stupid? Because I got £5,000 for it. You know, poets should be writing poems and not. I read a poem called The Understudy, which is kind of tying in with the title of this book, which is, there are a lot of characters in my poems that live, partly live lives. They're waiting for the big moment, the big part, become the hero, the lover, or center stage, and so often it just doesn't happen. So this poem, The Understudy, came about when I was at a Leonard Cohen concert, and this is one of Leonard Cohen's lines. If there's any fans here, you'll know it. The doctor works hour after hour. Now, I had plenty of time to think about it because I followed him around the country. I saw him in London, then went to Birmingham, then went to Belfast. So, not that I'm a fan or anything. So, this line just kept working away, and then it became a poem about things hanging in the balance, about just, that awful, awful waiting for something to happen. The Understudy. The doctor works hour after hour under park hands stilled at 5. A painterly suspension of the wrist joint, such precision on the block. Perspiring, the physician plucked shirt cuff, sallow moments under the knife, glint of the abyss. The obituarist, far from the scene of the crux, sharpens Lakeland pencils. Elevator door, concertina to a standstill. Upper chambers of the heart hang by a daybreak. A limp corvine in the camellia house cannot find his mate. Light leaks into evening. A blunted razor rests on a porcelain ledge. The understudy in the wings applies Leitner number 5. Next of kin snaps a clean wishbone. Sirens clamor for last atonement in Southside plazas. Checkered with total strangers asking for the possibility of a light. And I'll go from Leonard Cohen to James Joyce. The title of this poem, we had a bit of discussion about titles earlier. It's titled to Joyce's great story, I think the greatest story in the English language, is The Dead. And that image of snow falling on the Great Central Plain, I think is one of the, if you've seen the film, is one of the most beautiful images. And this is this kind of half world where people are living in some liminal twilight state. Afternoon on Central Plains Avenue. In the suburbs of the lamented, it is always late. Rumour is rife, none has forgotten the rattle of loam on a lid. Smiles are the order of the day, the week, and neighbours are hardly at home in the dilapidations of rented rooms. Phones go unanswered and cat flaps are seized. Clean, uncollected milk bottles clutter the stoops, meat safes are close to high. Singing is rare, gloves shift, but swimsuits stay on shelves. And no one fears heights. In the country where snow is general and the undertaker is king, the only books alone are elegiac. Fines are exempted. There is only one season and just enough light to grow bluebells. Occasionally, someone recalls the heaviness of apple peelings and shutters are locked. Churchyards are of the past. Cloud density eclipses the sun, moon, and stars. I'll do two poems about living in Belfast in the early 70s. One of the strange things about it was that life just goes on and as normal for most people, and people get engaged, people get married, and this is just a Saturday afternoon near where I was living, shooting on the street. A Saturday for wedding shoes, last item on the list, strappy, open, not too dance hall high. A grandstand, slow printer of a day, my father in our sitting room at home will be zoning in on recurring laps of a circuit, concentration effortless behind curtains that shut out the margin of coastal light. Slight late morning talk by the sub post office as I wait for the downtown bus. Car exhaust, electric floats, condensed tarmac morning. The greengrocer arranges button mushrooms, winter kale. When I get back on an afternoon, 91, he will be not long dead. I step down, shoes in a chain store bag. I've said yes to the box, tentative, and to keep them in after. My father by now will be steadying the vertical hold for a 10-6 local news bulletin. I realise more and more you have to explain things and problems. I bet you haven't an idea what a vertical hold is. It's that button on the television that just stops the picture scrolling round and round. I don't know if some of you still remember it. And so often you have to explain things if poems happened sometime in the past. This poem, The Events of May, is that strange time during in Belfast when the Ulster workers' strike brought the city to a standstill, and outside of Bedfords and University Land, nothing was happening, and it was very hard to get any news. The events of May. The ambulance depot windows blaze in the surveillance of hills, full beams morsed through trees on the path. Still in this quarter, men feign helplessness. At number 47, a stalled couple hope for Friday like the wait for the end of history. Steamed and resealed bills gather dust on the meter box. A blue and red edged envelope is losing its luff puff sticker to mice. Nothing arrives, nothing is sent on. At night, the couple window shop for eternity. She settles on 3 rupees. A widow in ground floor rooms listens at party walls. Order of news cuttings and red sound. She dusts the payphone in the hall over long. Stair treads day and night. Hotel doormen track the late operator, the random gatherers. In 32, a lone boy plays a pre-war Bechstein too fast on street corners. Funerals keep passing and repassing. Saint Susie's Eglantine borders are spreading out of control. I'll do 3 more poems. If I was Kieran Carson, I'd wait till I was way over my time and then say, I'll just do another 8. He didn't really. Louis McNeice comes from the same part of the world as I do, County Antrim, and he writes about very bleak landscapes, and I didn't really understand the reference in his poem Grey Bowl of Heaven until I spent some time on Inishman. A friend lent me a cottage to go and stay there for a while and right. And it's the only place that's grey above the horizon and grey below the horizon, because it's all rock. And this friend doesn't use the cottage anymore because he's a journalist in Washington. And he didn't tell me that the pub only opens on Fridays. Mm-hmm. And when you get there, there are three people and they're watching the sport and they ignore you. And I'd only been there a few days when a neighbour, when I say a neighbour, you know, it's about 2 miles up the road, came to the door and said, that room you're standing in now, you know, the man, a man in Boston was born in that room and he's just died, so they've brought him back and he's in the church down the road and you can go down and say hello to him because they're bringing him up here tomorrow because, so, you know, I headed out the back door, they brought him up on a tractor and, you know, parked at the door and I disappeared way up the back for a while. And that's what they do. That was the coming home. So this is a poem by Inishman. Grey bowl of heaven, overcast again on Detroit assembly lines, they dream of this. Washed up main fish boxes, others splintered from Galicia, a chessboard from out of nowhere. A Bostonian's coffin passes the home place on a tractor's tail lift. Morning landscape blaze in a dry, morning headscarf blaze in a dry landscape, the pattering of gravestones in the Venus. A ruinous winter for locals, you've still enough vocabulary to detect indifference, urgency, this many feelies out from land. 15 schoolyard infants sing in their relearned native tongue, traitorous waters conceal keels, masts, Castilian chalices. Beyond the Flaherty's casement, the upcast grey bowl of heaven, half doors and tombstones face east in unrequited expectation of rising noon. And this poem, Two Oaths, Something to the West, I wrote it in Sligo when I was at the Yates Summer School, staying in the glass house, you know, that great leaning tower of glass in the centre of the town. And at night from the hotel room, I looked across the quay, and, you know, there was the ship's chandlers and the laundromat. And there was a diner in which there was one man every night sitting late, and the staff were trying to put chairs on tables, and it was like Edward Hopper's painting, you know, Nighthawks, just this one solitary figure. And I thought of Thoreau's line about the mass of men leading lives of quiet desperation. The mass of men. Low wattage filaments quiver in the town's cheaper left. Tuesday again and motel guests slide safety chains in Detroit dust. Indifferent men with luggage on wheels fumble for key cards. Late night downtown trains, a day's heat boxed in, discharge the last brave workers with stuffed grocery sacks. In erased neighborhoods, zip coded children sleepwalk side by side in the blackness, all of us. In your walk up, the machine fitter on Third has reshuffled faces of 10th grade first kisses at summer camp, hears the beauty of the lilies in his mother's voice breaking. His current reality is Weather Channel, pizza delivery, a dry cough on the far side of the partition. All over town, couples in peeled rooms, back to back in the dark, feign slumber. Scenic calendars have most days circles, full lived lives, appointments kept, a tone of placid despair. The ball game postponed until Thursday. A woman somehow fires a single shot. In an interview recently, I was asked why that poem wasn't a novel. And in a poem you can do two chapters in a single line. But I also didn't have to explain why the woman fired a single shot. I finish. Seems to be a lot of well, there's a lot of American, I promise. We talked about this tonight. I am really an American. I got stuck in a lift, an elevator, as you say, in a tower block in Seattle. And what you try to do instead of totally panic when you're on your own is try and do things in your mind to just keep calm. Elevator in the dark. I thought though that when I get out of here, mantras, then ways to slow your breathing. 2 hours and 2 minutes now. It's Labor Day weekend, Friday, concierge long gone. Right now he's ordering fajitas at Garcia's 3 blocks away. I've tried press button firmly, but no guaranteed response in 2 minutes. Above, only lift gear, dense cloud and night sky. Far below, subway tracks, graffiti, an underworld, and here between an abyss of lift shaft. 2 blocks east, the night's firefighters clock in, watch a pre-recorded ball game maybe. They're hoping for a slow news weekend. I rework classic chess gambits, lift Confederate generals, just 49 skates, forget North Dakota, offer a makeshift prayer or two under the low green of backup lights, and conjure that fourth grade Bible frontispiece, the ladder headed heavenward, gleaming, radiant. It all stretches up, up, eons of infatuation, commitments, paychecks, ordinary enough things to hanker after in this jammed, late Seattle Friday elevator. I read that from the University of Notre Dame, and afterwards, you know, those very earnest Midwest students, afterwards one boy said, look, if you got 49 states and you didn't get North Dakota, you must have got South Dakota. How didn't you get North Dakota? So, sort of a literal mind that you don't want at a poetry reading. Thank you for listening.